Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt, and we're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, work out, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By Velofix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we just sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport to help out. Go to challengeathletes.org. Check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. Our next guest is the first time we've gotten to chat with the 10th coach in Anaheim Ducks history, who also just finished the Leadville 100 mountain bike race for the 10th time. His name is Dallas Eakins. Dallas, how are you?
I'm excellent, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so Dallas, I wanted to get into your background. Did you grow up a hockey guy, always hockey?
Well, you know what's interesting? I've kind of lived two different lives. I was actually born in Dade City, Florida, and lived a very rural life there.
Yeah.
Never knew my birth father, and then my mother ended up marrying a Canadian guy who was living in Dade City, Florida, a long-distance truck driver, and he became the only father that I ever knew, and he moved us to Peterborough, Ontario, Canada, when I was just turning eight.
What a shock that must have been.
Yeah, and that's where I started picking up a hockey stick, and then it was full on.
So it was just one of those things where you just fell into the sport and just loved it.
Well, yeah, and you know what's interesting? I can still remember pulling in. We went and lived with my father's mother to get started up there, and I still remember pulling in on Swanson Avenue there, and in early, I think it was early October, and I remember kids playing hockey on the street, and that's how you made friends. Like, if you wanted to hang out, you had to learn how to play, and that's what I did.
And did you, how long was it before you felt, you know what, I'm actually pretty good at this?
It probably wasn't until I was kind of 14 or 15, like I trudged along and got a little better every year. And probably when I was like 14 or 15, I knew there was maybe a chance I might be able to, you know, get a scholarship or play junior hockey in Canada. And I was lucky enough to be drafted by my hometown, the Peterborough Petes. Although a later pick, it got my foot in the door.
And did you ever have aspirations of playing in the NHL?
Well, when I started playing, like, you know, when you're a kid in Canada, I think every kid that who starts playing at any level, you're always looking, going, man, that would be, I think, really awesome. Obviously, that was the end game that I was looking for, and obviously a big dream that was, you know, mostly realized. I got to spend probably 4 or 5 years in the NHL. I was a journeyman guy. I was always kind of like the 23rd man on the roster, not in the lineup every night. I was up and down the minors a million times. But forged out 16 years of pro hockey. I played over 1,000 games.
Yeah.
I'm humbled and so grateful for that unbelievable experience.
Well, you played, what, 882 games in the AHL, 43 goals and 179 assists. And when you're playing minor league hockey, and, you know, tell me a little bit the difference between the speed and just the size of the guys when you go from AHL to NHL.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's one of the great myths, is that it's not so much that the guys are stronger and faster at the NHL level. Like, if we were to line them up, like I'm at the rink right now, we've got guys that played in the AHL last year, we've got NHL guys here. If I just went and lined them up on the rink and said, hey, let's have a race to the other end, I'm quite sure there'd be a couple AHL guys that would probably beat a lot of these NHL guys. So it's not so much the speed and the strength. It's the skill and then that intangible of being able to read the game with your brain. And, you know, I if you talk about the greatest player ever, like Wayne Gretzky,
yeah,
you know, maybe not the fittest guy, maybe not the strongest or the fastest, but he was definitely, his head for the game was amazing. So, you know, that's what separates the guys from the NHL and the AHL players, is that the NHL guys are so skilled with their brains, and then they also have a lot of skill in their bags too.
I was reading one part where when you were playing for the in Cincinnati with the Cyclones, and one of the radio DJ said, this guy will never score. He won't score more than 3 goals, and I'll shave my head, right? if he doesn't, and you scored 6 goals, what, in the first month or so?
Yeah, like I was never much of a goal scorer. I was more of a defensive guy.
Right.
I had back in those days, I had toughness was a big part of the game, and so I had that in my pocket too. But yeah, that was if I remember correctly, I think it was Wildman Walker.
Yep, and Dennis Wildman Walker, WEBN.
Yeah, that's right. And back then, that arena that we played in, it was interesting. It was a mini replica of the old Maple Leaf Gardens.
Yeah.
And it was called the Cincinnati Gardens. And that place on the weekends, like it would be sold out. It held around like 10,000 people. And on a Friday or Saturday night, Wildman came out to center ice at the end of the first and second period. And I actually got the first swipe at his head. Like, imagine that. Like, in between periods, a player who is playing the game is actually starting to shave somebody's head. But I took the first swipe of his hair, and then they finished him off out there. So, yeah.
So
great minor league story.
Yeah, when you retired, and then you went to, after retiring 2006, you become head coach of the Marlies. Is that how it's pronounced? In 2009. What was when all of a sudden you're coaching from all those years of playing minor league and NHL hockey? What did you take from all those years that helped you as a coach for that first job?
Well, you know what? The great thing about my playing career that worked out well, being a journeyman guy, is I got to play with a lot of players, and I got to play for a lot of coaches. And My greatest influence was Roger Nielsen, who was like a second father to me. Raj coached in the NHL a ton. He's in the Hall of Fame as a builder. And, you know, it's kind of like you're not taking notes, but you kind of are taking notes.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, there's so many experiences, and there were certain things that I saw coaches do that I just shook my head at. And there's a whole lot of things that coaches did that that really inspired me. And then also, like, playing with guys, I always think the smartest guys in any sport are the people that are actually doing the sport, not necessarily the coaches. And so all of that wrapped up into an interest in it. And, you know, especially like being in that American League so long and finishing my career out there, I took great satisfaction, and it really drove me to help others. And there, I was never prouder along my career, if there was my defense partner or like a young player on our team that, you know, maybe you're helping out in the weight room or you're helping him out with his game, and then he would get called up to the NHL. Like, it was almost like you were the proud big brother or the proud father. And just with that kind of feeling driving me along, it just seemed like a natural progression to get into coaching.
And then you get the NHL job, right, with Edmonton, and you're coaching there for 2 years. And that's, I mean, Edmonton, man, that was the title capital of the country. And what did you learn from that experience as you've been a head coach at a different level? Now you're head coach and on the big show. Transition for you, how hard was that?
Yeah, it wasn't, to put it kindly, it certainly wasn't fun. I think the greatest lesson that comes out of that, it's one of those, like, I don't wish my experience there on anyone, but I wish it for everyone. And like, coming out of it, like, adversity is such an amazing gift.
Yes.
And even though that went not only terribly for myself, but terribly for those players there and most importantly, the fans, it's amazing when you come out on the other side. And I think it just really put everything into perspective. Like, hey, this is just a game. There's once you come out, you've developed this level of toughness that maybe that wasn't there before. And you know, since then, there's not much you can throw at me these days in my job that can get me too rattled. It ended up as tough as an experience as it was. It's one of my greatest experiences of my coaching.
Well, and then you go from that to the Gulls here in San Diego, and you guys were on a roll, right? You developed a great program with the Gulls, and the Pacific Division final in first 2 years. You guys were on a roll. A lot of your players. That must be the hardest part when you're coaching at that level. You know that if you get good players, they're going to the big show, and you lose that guy who's a big part of your success. Talk a little bit about coaching at the Gulls, coming from Edmonton, where you're a head coach, and then coming to the minor leagues, and then now you're going back to the NHL.
Yeah, just really super proud of our organization there. We were a new franchise, super proud of our people that were in the marketing side and the ticketing side. Really proud of our players and the program that not I developed or the coaches developed, but just kind of all as one. Like we all had different ideas, right, from the marketing to the ownership, to the coaches and to the players. And we all developed an amazing program there. We were able to develop a lot of players for the NHL. We were able to win a whole lot of games. The experience in that arena is an amazing one for the fans. And for the last couple of years there, we led the league in attendance. So it's just been an amazing journey. San Diego was obviously just an incredible place for my family to land on our feet and to live there. It was certainly a very special 4 years, in a whole bunch of different regards.
Yeah, Ernie Hahn is actually a close friend, and I love what they've done with the Ducks, with the Gulls. The Gulls pack them in for minor league hockey. For minor league hockey in San Diego is pretty special.
Yeah, and there's a long history up there, and I got to know Ernie very, very well over the last few years, and an amazing person, and he's got deep roots in that San Diego area.
So now you're the head coach with Anaheim Ducks, and obviously it's a different game. Do you have a lot of the players who played for you with the Gulls?
Well, I've coached a lot of them.
Like, yeah.
Just because being in San Diego for 4 years, there's a number of guys that are full time NHL players now that I coached in years one and two and three, a bunch of our rookies from last year got their feet wet here, so they're going to challenge for jobs, and it's been just such a exciting transition. I still kind of pinch myself that I am the head coach of the Anaheim Ducks, and it's an amazing feeling. And I'll go back to my first stint as a head coach. When I showed up there, it was kind of me and them, and because I had never coached any of the players, I didn't know any of the management, I didn't know the ownership, I'd never really been in that city before, and here it's right away, it's we.
Right.
And it's because I've worked with my boss here for 4 years. I've been in Anaheim numerous times. I know all the staff here. I know most of the players. So it's not new to me. It's very familiar, and it's just a wonderful place to start for all of us.
So talk a little bit about mountain biking. And 2010, you end up at the Leadville 100 mountain bike. And that is, you're talking, you know, the ride goes, what, from 9,000 to 12,000. You gain thousands of, you go from 9,200 to 12,620 feet, 15,000 feet of climbing and descending. What led a hockey player to get into that level of mountain biking?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a funny story. And it was, I was working for the Toronto Maple Leafs at the time, and Ron Wilson was the head coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And Ron was, I'd heard him say it a few times behind closed doors, and then I saw him mention it a couple times in the media that he just didn't think the team was fit enough. And he'd become very focused on VO2 max. And now I'm still not sure if VO2 max has much to do with a hockey player, but it didn't matter. The head coach was focused on that. He wanted that to improve. And so I walked into his office and I said, hey, if you want this to improve, we might want to employ some outside help. And so we ended up hiring Chris Carmichael's company.
Oh, yeah. CTS.
Of Colorado. Yeah. It was back then it was called Trainwright, and now it's
that's right.
CTS.
He was CTS, so. He worked with Lance back in the day.
Yeah, that's right. So Chris came in. I got to know Chris very well. Another guy that's become a dear friend is Dean Golick, who still has connections there and has done a lot of really cool stuff here over the last few years, but. You know, as our friendship and our working relationship, got going, I used to bug Chris, right? Chris was in the Tour de France, and he was like a tiny guy, and we'd start going back and forth about, you hockey players think you're so tough, and I'm like, well, hey, listen, you ride a bike for a living, like, give me a break. What kind of toughness is there? And then Chris finally had enough of me, and he goes, hey, hey, big mouth, why don't you do this? Why don't you come to this race here and you and I'll have at it? And I was like, okay, that's fine. How hard can it be? Just go ride a bike. And so I obviously went and did my research on Leadville, and I trained hard for it, and I got there, and Chris kicked the crap out of me on the course. It wasn't even close. But Leadville has been, it's kind of become a very inspiring place. It's something that's very familiar to me. It's almost like I can almost call it home.
Yeah.
Even though I only spend, 5 days a year there. And it's, I always say it's the best day ever. And it's the worst day ever. And usually after that race, I'm like, I'm never, ever coming back here again. And then, the next morning I wake up and that feeling of being sore and being dehydrated, but then just so inspired by, the people that you kind of suffered with for those 100 miles and people's different stories and just the, I don't know, it's like a massive cleansing for me.
Yep.
that day on so many levels. And I know you and a lot of your listeners understand that. Like, there hasn't been a year, and I'm not embarrassed to say this, there has not been a year there that I just don't have, and it's usually near the end of the race and the last few miles, but that I just don't have this guttural 30-second cry. Like, I mean, it just, everything comes out of me. And, it's a special race for me, and just something that I've really enjoyed, and I can't not imagine not going there to do it.
So 10 years, when you do 10, you get the belt buckle that's basically the size of Vermont, right? It's a big buckle. Are you wearing that right now?
Well, I'm not wearing it right now, but I'll tell you what. Over the other years, hey, you get your buckle, you're a finisher, that's great. There's been times where I've grabbed it. There's been other days where it was like, hey, we were leaving right after the race, and it wasn't the buckle that I was after. But I'll tell you what, when you somehow survived and your bike didn't blow up on you, or your
body
didn't blow up, and you've got 9 under your belt, that number 10, and you're getting that big one, you're making sure everything goes right that day. And that next day, I was so proud to be, I think there was maybe 23 of us. I can't remember the number. It was 20-something of us were there for our 10th in a row. And it was a proud moment to, you know, to go up there and to get that buckle, and especially with my wife and my girls there. And we had friends in from Vancouver that came in to help support. So it was a great day, because you start wrapping around your head going, you know, like when you're at, if something was going to go wrong in race three or race five or whatever it was, okay, that's, I get it. But when you get there and you're like, I've gotten through 9 of these somehow, like this is crazy. And now to think that I was able to get 10 done in a row and you know, nothing goes south on me along the way, or at least survive it a couple of years, just getting in under the 12 hours. It's impressive.
Yeah, actually, one of our Challenge Athlete Foundation athletes, One Arm Willie Stewart, this was his 10th in a row, and he got the big buckle as well. So that is so cool. And there's sort of this, you know, runners, triathletes, cyclists, mountain bikers, there's a, I call it a fraternity of suffering, because you all know, if you're doing Leadville, if you're doing Western States, running, whatever it happens to be, you're suffering. There's points that day that you don't know if you can turn your crank one more time. And that getting 10 in a row like that is pretty amazing, Dallas.
Well, I'll tell you what, the founder of the racer, Tim Chobler,
yep,
one of the very first years I was there, I think it may have been the first year. Yeah, he told, and this is right across all those sports that you just you mentioned, that whole suffering thing. And I think about what he says, like, not only when I'm, you know, on my bike or I'm running or doing something like that, like I think it, like in life too, when you've got like a challenging moment, like. And Ken said, was telling all the riders this day, and he goes, you know what, just think of, you know, you signed up for the race and you got in, and then what'd you do? You started telling everybody, right? Started telling everybody that you're coming. And now everybody knows you're here. And he goes, there's going to be a whole lot of times tomorrow at the race that you're going to want to quit. And you know what you're going to do? You can't call them and say, yeah, I quit. He goes, so what you're going to do is you're going to put your head down and effing pedal. Now, he didn't say effing. He said the real word. And it stuck with me. It has stuck with me forever. And it's like, yeah, just put your head down and effing pedal.
I love it.
And that's what happens. Like, you just get the spots where you're like, I'm done. And you just put your head down and keep going.
Love it. Hey, Dallas, thank you so much for taking so much time. Congratulations on your new gig with the Anaheim Ducks. We'll be watching. Hopefully we'll get a group up and come watch a game.
Yeah, absolutely. You're always welcome. And you know what, Bob? Thank you for all the work you're doing with the Challenge athletes. I see those athletes everywhere. I've seen them at Leadville. My wife is into the lot of half Ironman.
Yep.
I see them out when I'm out on my bike, and I tell you what, I'm not sure I can find anything more inspiring than that.
Thank you, sir. Dallas Eakins has been our guest again. This is Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shops. By Polar. Winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we just sent out 3,260 grants, 260 grants totaling $4.8 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here.